Okay, ladies and gentlemen, good morning everybody for the lecture on diagnostic medical image processing. I wish the days back when you just press a button and things happen. It's on. Good. We are currently in the section or in the chapter on image reconstruction or volume reconstruction. So the problem that we are considering is we have a 3D object. We have different views on the from different directions, X-ray views. And our task is compute out of the X-ray projections, the original signal. And what we are considering currently is instead of reconstructing a 3D object, we say we reconstruct the 3D object slice by slice. And first, we consider the case that we have parallel projections. According to Bayer's law, we know how the X-ray particles are attenuated. We have parallel projections, and we have seen how the Fourier transform of the projection is linked to the 2D Fourier transform of the object to be reconstructed. With each projection, we get the 2D Fourier transform of the slice to be reconstructed along the line that goes through the origin and is parallel to the detector line. Yeah, that's the Fourier slice theorem that we all remember. The Fourier slice theorem. And then we remembered, or we looked at the sampling pattern we get for the 2D Fourier transform by each projection line. And we found out that the 2D Fourier transform of the function to be reconstructed is sampled using polar coordinates. You remember that? Polar coordinates. Polar coordinates. And then we incorporated the coordinate transform into the Fourier slice theorem, and we ended up with a filtered back projection algorithm. So, by the coordinate transform from the polar coordinates to Cartesian ones, we found out that f at the position x and y, the function we want to reconstruct, is 1/2 over 0 to 2 pi. So we integrate over the whole angle range. We have to divide by 1/2 because each projection ray is counted twice. And then we have minus infinity to plus infinity. And then we have p of s theta. What was theta? Theta is the rotation angle. What is s? That's the index on the detector for a given theta. And this here is convolved with a kernel function or multiplied h of x cosine theta plus y sine theta minus s d s d theta. Yeah. So here we have a convolution of this function with this kernel. This is the filter that we get if we back transform, or if we compute the inverse Fourier transform of the absolute value function. Yeah, that was the REM filter that we have incorporated into the back projection formula due to the coordinate transform. This is nothing else but the absolute value of the Jacobian of the transform. Yeah? If you didn't follow up carefully the previous lectures, this might sound like Chinese to you now, but not for you, but might sound like German for you. Yeah? So that's the story. That's the story. Do we remember how this kernel looks like? Because we need it today. So H, let's say, of S is, you remember that? That's the inverse Fourier transform over all omega. Yeah? That's the kernel we have to use. And good morning, Stefan. Yeah. And we also have seen different kernels, different approximations of this kernel. We also combined this kernel with a smoothing operator, like the Shep-Logan filtering, yeah, where we incorporated also a low-pass filter in this high-pass filter that we have here. And so we do reconstruction. OK? Good morning, sir. Good morning. So you can write in the evaluation, he's so nice to us. Good. And what was the next step in the story? What was the next step in the story we are considering? We looked at this here. Yeah. We looked at this here and said, instead of parallel projection, we have the situation that we have an X-ray tube where we have an X-ray focus, and our projection rays, they all intersect in a single point in the ideal case. So we have fan beam geometry. If we see things like that, a bell rings in our head telling us, oh yeah, that's a nonlinear projection mapping, homogeneous coordinates, go one dimension higher to deal with linear mappings. But that's something we haven't considered in the current context. The question that we are tackling, or that we are facing, is can we somehow use the results for parallel projection to come up with a powerful algorithm for fan beam reconstruction? And one thing that we have considered was the point spread function. We have noticed that the point spread function is shift invariant, and that the point spread function is the same for parallel projection and perspective projection. And the point spread function is 1 over r. That means the farther we are away from the point that we are considering, the lower the weight within the filter is. And then we said, OK, we do a reconstruction a way that we do back projection and after that filtering. From a theoretical point of view, that's a proper algorithm. From a practical point of view, that's not as good. And so we try to look into this reconstruction formula, and we try to adapt it to the perspective projection case. And what we have also done in the past two lectures was we have we said that our projection in the fan beam geometry is given by G gamma beta. So that's the measured intensity measured, but a little bit transformed. That's the log I zero correction that we did before. And for angle beta and gamma. Yeah? And beta was the rotation angle. That's the intersection of the central projection ray with the y-axis. And the gamma was the deviation, the angle the currently considered projection ray deviates from the central ray. Yeah? That were the two angles that we have in mind. And then we found out a relationship between p theta, no, we call it s theta, right? S theta and g. And we found out that theta is, and that was a very brilliant lecture 1 week ago where I totally screwed things up. What was the relationship between theta, gamma, and beta? Yijin? Beta plus gamma. Hold on, and S is? Sine gamma. Okay, so if we have now a set of projections, G, beta, gamma, we can compute the corresponding PS theta values. And based on that, we can do a standard filtered back projection reconstruction once PS theta is given. Huh? The drawback is that we have to capture our projections and then do the transformation. And by transforming things, we have to do an interpolation of the measured values because we do not hit the grid points on our detector, but we are somewhere in between, so we have to interpolate and lose frequencies by that. But the transformation is something that we can compute. We can convert the measurements for all gammas and betas into S theta values, PS theta values, and then do back projection. Okay? And now what we want to do is we want to find an algorithm where we can take the projection for a given beta and take the measurement and do just a convolution of the measurement with some filter and then back project things step by step. So we can do a on the fly reconstruction. Projection comes in, filtering, back projection, throw it away. Projection comes in, filtering, back projection, throw it away. And what we have to do for that is we have to look at the reconstruction formula here. And let's see what's going to happen if we consider the point x, y in polar coordinates. So we are now doing a weird thing. Initially, we had our Fourier transform in polar coordinates. Then we did the back transform to get the function in Cartesian coordinates. Now we have the reconstruction formula, filtering back projection. And we are considering things now in polar coordinates because we consider the equiangular case now, the equiangular case in reconstruction. So what we do is that's where we stopped last week. Yeah? We now continue. We want to reconstruct the function fxy in the fx plane. So we have a point here, xy, and we want to compute f of xy. And below we have already seen that's 1/2 integral from 0 to 2 pi, that's the back projection integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, p s theta h x cosine theta plus y sine theta minus s d theta. So that's the reconstruction. That's what a CT scanner does if you have parallel projection. And now we transform the point xy into polar coordinates. So we have here the phi, and here we have the length r. So if I give you the phi and the r, then you know which point xy is considered, right? So x is r times cosine phi, and y is r times sine phi. That's the coordinate transform. And we can apply the coordinate transform in the above double integral. The fact that these two parameters do not take part in the integration, we do not even have to fix anything with respect to the integration variables, no Jacobian, no nothing. So we get here f of r phi is 1/2 integral from 0 to pi. Integral from minus infinity to plus infinity p of s theta times h. And now I replace x by r cosine phi cosine theta plus r sine phi sine theta minus s. And then I have here the ds d theta. Sorry for squeezing things in here. And this here, by using the theorems of trigonometric functions, we can look that up. R cosine is it phi? Theta minus phi. I have to admit, I don't know these formulas by heart. I have to look these things up. Yeah? If you know these things by heart, you should really check whether you invest your brain power for the right things. Yeah? So an engineer should look at the cosine terms and sine terms and just think, maybe there is something, and then you look it up. Yeah? The important thing is that you have the idea there is something, yeah? And then you look it up. And there are so many variations. If you waste your brain power for all the variations, I mean, why should you do that? And I'm sure somebody's watching the video now and says there is an easy rule of thumb how to remember these things, and the professor should know this as well. Maybe there is a rule of thumb. I don't know that. Send me an email. I get so many emails regarding my lectures, by the way, from China, India, everywhere in the world, where people watch the videos and find it quite exciting. Even the jokes are appreciated across the cultures. Good. Okay. So we have, once again, FR phi. And I have to say, it's ugly to massage the formulas. At the end, we want to find something like the integral over all angles and the convolution of the measurement with something. Yeah. So a little bit of massaging is still required. So let me just write the final version here. It's 1/2, 0 pi, 2 pi, minus infinity, plus infinity, p s theta, h cosine r times cosine theta minus phi minus s d s d theta. So. Okay. And what do we do next? Bless you. What do we do next? We now replace theta by gamma plus beta, and we replace s by d times sine gamma. Okay, so we now do a coordinate transform of the variables we integrate over. So we again need, first of all, the transformation of the variables and the Jacobian. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Give us a smile to the camera. So that is exactly the point where we stopped last time. So we can go ahead. Now Ingvar is with us. And I think I have explained it way better than last time, right? So Ingvar missed the point now, the crucial point. So now we take the coordinate transform over there. Who can tell me what the Jacobian is? The Jacobian, the determinant of the Jacobian. We have seen this last week already. So we compute the derivative with respect to R and phi. And we have seen last time that the Jacobian is the derivative with respect to gamma and beta. And we had the Jacobian d times sinus gamma. Yeah? Huh? Pardon me?
Not cosine.
Did I say sine? Oh, cosine. Sorry. Cosine. So we have the sine function and the derivative is the cosine. That's right. So that was the Jacobian that we are required to incorporate here. And so we have f of r phi is 1 over 2 integral 0 to pi minus pi half to pi half g of gamma beta. Now we replace the p s theta by the g gamma beta. Yeah, that's the conversion we do. Times h r cosine, and now we replace the theta by gamma plus beta. Minus phi minus d sine gamma. That's the s. Yeah, so that's the theta. That's the s. And then, sorry for squeezing it in again, we have the d times cosine gamma, and then we integrate over gamma and beta. Gamma and beta. Here, last time, we also wrote the partial derivatives with respect to gamma and beta. OK? And if we look at that here, sir?
Where does the gamma come from in the Jacobian?
Where does the gamma come from? We compute the Jacobian here with respect to beta and gamma of these two mappings. No. No, R and phi is the xy transform. That is not related to the variables we integrate over. Now we replace s by d sine gamma and d and phi, sorry, theta by beta plus gamma. So our new variables are beta and gamma. And then we compute, and d is constant. That's the distance to the rotation center. And so we compute the derivative with respect to beta. So it's 1, 0, the first column. And the second column is the derivative with respect to gamma. It's 1 and d times cosine. And that's it. I think I did that last time on the board already, on the blackboard. Good. Unfortunately, we are not happy with this inner term because this is not a convolution. Yeah? That's a product of two functions integrated over, or of three functions even, if you take the cosine gamma here, integrated over gamma, but that's not a convolution. So what we have to do is we have to remassage this to get a convolution. Why are we so eager to get a convolution? Because if we have a convolution of two signals, it's in the discrete easier to compute than having a product of two functions and do a numerical integration. Yeah? Convolution is very easy to compute, and we know how to deal with convolution. Yeah? Just mirror the one function and then shift it over all the signal, and you get the convolved output. So the question is, how do we get this function into a convolution? So this is not a convolution so it can be computed, but it's not so easy to compute it. Do you think I like this derivation? What do you think? It's very technical. I actually don't like it. And the reason that I also have a piece of paper to reconfirm each and every step just tells you that you easily get lost. And I won't ask you this derivation in the oral exam. Yeah? If you are with Andreas Meyer, things might be different. If you are with me, I won't ask it. I can't tell you what Andreas is asking. But if you think through what I was just telling you, that means maybe I wouldn't make a 1.0 with Andreas as an examiner. Even I wouldn't make it. Maybe. Maybe. But on the other hand, the nice thing is I'm his boss. And if I tell him as an answer, that doesn't matter, it's not so important, he might accept it. If you say it, I'm not sure. That's the nice thing if you are at the other side of this game here. Sometimes when the students show up in the oral exam, they appear rather nervous. Yeah, and I tell them, you appear nervous, and they say yes, and I say, I'm not. And then I cool people down. Usually in the first 2 to 3 minutes, I have a small talk with the students, and then they feel better, and then I really jump in.
Where do the limits of the inner integral come from?
You mean from minus pi half to pi half? Yeah. Think about it. I mean, we integrate over an angle, yeah? We replace the s by an angle, so we don't go from minus infinity to plus infinity. But we go from, that's the angle gamma, and gamma is this one here. And if you go with gamma, so this is the central ray, okay? Intersects the y-axis with the angle beta, and then your gamma goes this way in the positive or in the negative, and this way in the positive. And if you want to cover the range from minus infinity to plus infinity, you have 90 degrees in this direction and 90 degrees in this direction. So that's where it comes from. Okay? If you download the older slides out of the year 2011 or so, these boundaries are not correct on the slides. So, good. These boundaries are not correct on the slides, and these slides were done by Andreas Meyer. And that means if Andreas Meyer asks you to do the derivation, you get him. Yeah, you can tell him, look at your slides from 2011. There's also a mistake.
Maybe I should bring that along to prove.
Yeah, bring it and then tell him, look, you are doing mistakes, so I'm also allowed to do mistakes. Okay. Good. I'll come back to our slides later, right? I prefer to do these things on the board because then you have a chance to follow and I'm required to think through it, and it's not as fast as it would be with the slides. So what we do next is, and now I become a little more hand-waving from now on, if I look at the situation, I'm in the xy plane, xy. Here is my x-ray focus. X-ray focus. If Andreas is asking you about the derivation, you can say, well, in practice, it's not an x-ray focus, it's an x-ray area, so all the formulas do not work anyway, so why should I learn these, yeah? So, x-ray focus. Then here is our rotation center. The distance is d, okay? And now we are considering, here is our beta, and now we are considering to reconstruct this point. Yeah, that's the point xy where we want to reconstruct the function. And we know that this point here in our current setup is not identified by x and y coordinate, but by this angle phi and the scaling factor r. Yeah? So we take the unit vector, rotate it by phi, and then we scale it by r, and that's the point where we are currently at. Okay? And now we call this distance here from the focal point to the point we are currently considering, we call that d prime. And this angle here we call gamma prime. So for a selected point, we have a d prime and a gamma prime. And so we translate the point in polar coordinates into coordinates that are given by the setup, that means by the x-ray focus in space, the gamma prime, the angle, that's the deviation from the central projection ray, and the d prime, that's the distance. Okay? So we have our xy coordinate system, we have our r phi representation, then we have our x-ray tube, and now we express the point in space that we want to reconstruct by gamma prime. That's the angle according to the current setup of our x-ray tube and the projection geometry and the angle. Yeah, the deviation from the central ray in terms of the angle, and we call it gamma prime, and then the distance to the focal point. Okay? Does this make us happy? Amen, we are jumping back and forth between 500 different coordinate systems. Yeah. And the only clue about that is that we end up with a convolution formula at the end. That's why we do this transform into the x-ray coordinate system in terms of polar coordinates. It's not fun. You might also ask, how can you come up with this idea? The answer is that took tons of hours of research and trial and error. And at the end, somebody came up with this type of transform and found out that you can rewrite things as a convolution. The motivation was, damn, I'm not sure whether I'm allowed to say this, oh my God, yeah, oh my God, I want to have a convolution back projection formula, and what's written on the right hand side here is some weird integral of a product function and a back projection, and I don't like it. Yeah? That was the motivation. And then hundreds of researchers started to massage the formulas. Yeah? And someone came up with this weird coordinate transform and found out if I formalize things in this and that coordinate system, then it can be written as a convolution. Okay? That was the motivation. So we have the transformation. So if we now rewrite R cosine beta plus gamma plus, minus phi, that's the term here. R cosine gamma plus beta minus phi minus d sine gamma. So we express this again. So what is this gamma here? And what is this gamma here? That's a different gamma. Yeah? That's a different gamma. We integrate over gamma. So we consider different gammas. Yeah? That's not the gamma prime here. That's an arbitrary gamma in our integral. Yeah? The beta is the second variable. That means that's the rotation around the center of rotation for a given integral in the middle that we, or for a given, for the considered inner integral, we can assume that the beta is arbitrary but fixed. So let's consider this whole situation here for a fixed beta and for various gamma. And now we can rewrite the situation, and that's what I'm not doing now here for this type of notation, for the considered point xy, for the considered point r phi, or the considered point gamma prime d prime. We can convert between these three coordinate systems easily. Yeah, easily. This is d prime times sine gamma prime minus gamma for a fixed beta. Okay? Now Ingvar says, I don't see it. I just tell you, this is trigonometry, so we have to add in this formula, in the figure in the left-hand side, an arbitrary but fixed gamma, and then transform between these things. It's geometry. Yeah? I can tell you with the 10th grade trigonometry, you are able to work on that. So sit back home and try to find this relationship out. You will also find in our slides, I think, a figure where it's more detailed. But for us, for me, it's just important that you see the three coordinate systems, xy, phi r, and then with respect to this coordinate system, gamma prime, d prime. Yeah? And then you can massage the formulas this way. So we end up with the following formula. R phi is 1 over 2 integral. So we rotate around 360 degrees. We rotate from minus pi half to plus pi half to have the minus infinity to plus infinity integration over the detector. G gamma beta, we all know what gamma and beta is, and we measure gamma and beta. Yeah? For a fixed beta, we have our detector, our curved detector, equiangularly sampled. And then we have H, and then we have d prime sine gamma prime minus gamma. And then we have the cosine weight over there. Cosine gamma d gamma d beta. I always have to squeeze the end in. I had to keep the gap smaller here. Can you read it, or should I rewrite it again? Can you read it? from an aesthetic point of view. Let me rewrite it again, because that's important to see. So we have here the integral from minus pi. 1 second, it's coming back. Don't worry. Okay, I hope it's right. So, we should write this now here. I could also write gamma and d prime here. Gamma prime and d prime. But if you now look at the formula, it very much looks like already like a convolution here. Yeah? So you have gamma, and then you have gamma prime minus gamma. You see? We are getting closer. We are getting closer. Yeah? So we are getting closer. And what we now do is we take a wonderful property of the ramp filter. And let me just write the ramp filter again. The ramp filter we have seen it today already. The ramp filter is h of s is, once again, what is it? Integral omega absolute value inverse Fourier transform 2 pi I omega s d omega integral from minus infinity to plus infinity. So, and now we have h of here we have h of d times a sinus of an angle. Yeah? So let's consider h of d prime sine of an angle. Let's call the angle gamma or gamma prime, whatever you want. Doesn't matter. Or let's forget about the prime. Just let's look at the filter response at position d times sine gamma. So we just plug it in. It's the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, omega e to pi I omega. And our s is now d sine gamma d omega. OK? And now you can imagine what's going to happen. We massage this integral somehow. Yeah? For instance, you know these tricks from school. Sometimes you add a number, and then you immediately subtract the number, and nothing happened. Or you multiply a factor and divide by the factor and hope that things become better. Yeah? And that's what we do. So I multiply here by gamma. Let's say I'm multiplying here by gamma and I divide by gamma. I can do that except gamma is zero, but we are engineers. If gamma is zero, we add a little epsilon and then it's fine again. Yeah? So. Now we have here something like bithermia. Oops. Like this term here. And what we now do is we now replace the omega we replace the omega by omega times d times sine gamma divided by sine gamma. So we do a variable transform. So we will now get this factor here and also this factor here. So if I multiply from left with the square of it, things are disappearing again with the inverse square of it. So I can write here is gamma divided by d sine gamma square. Now I integrate from plus infinity to minus infinity, so the borders of the integration, the bounds, boundaries are not affected by this transform. And I get here omega sine gamma times d divided by gamma e to the power of 2 pi I d sine gamma divided by gamma omega times gamma d omega. And now I call this variable here omega prime, and I can write this as gamma divided by d sine gamma square times the point transformed at omega prime. So I can if I have to compute the function at this point, d sine gamma. The massaging that we did is that we can multiply this with a prefactor gamma divided by d sine gamma square and transform the original function at the point, at the currently considered point. And this we plug now in and we get I did a mistake here, sorry. This here is not gamma prime because we integrate over gamma prime, but here we get the gamma here. So we do that, and we call the filter fan beam filter. That's our definition that we are considering. And I call this d divided by 1/2 gamma divided by sine gamma square times the original ramp filter. And if I use this, I get the following reconstruction formula. F r phi is 0 to 2 pi 1 over d prime square. D prime square, remember this, that's the distance of the x-ray focus to the currently considered point. Integral from minus p half to plus p half cosine gamma g of gamma beta, that's what we measure on our detector, h fan at gamma minus gamma prime, gamma minus gamma prime minus gamma, and then we integrate over gamma and beta. And the relationship between d prime and gamma prime and r and phi is given by this figure here. Now, the original gamma is you have here your detector, and you consider an arbitrary point here, and here you have your original gamma, and we integrate over gamma. So it's varying here. We integrate over the gamma. So that's another one. We consider different rays. We do not consider only the ray that goes through the point that we are currently considering. Yeah? I know it's weird. You easily get lost. The important thing is that you have all the coordinate systems in mind. We have the theta s coordinate system. We have the beta gamma coordinate system. We have the xy coordinate system. We have the r phi coordinate system. And we have the d prime gamma prime coordinate system. Yeah, and we have to switch back and forth between these two, these n, four or five.
Therefore, we should compute d prime and gamma prime from r and
p. Yeah, right. I mean, that's something that you. But look at this. You take the original signal, you cosine weight it. That means the larger the gamma gets, the smaller the value is. Yeah? The smaller the weight is of g gamma beta. We call this cosine weighting. Give me 1 second. What was the question?
Should there be a d for the cosine, or where does it go?
Yeah, but how did you get there? Because like you had a d on the denominator, d squared on the denominator.
Yeah, but hold on. That I made for simplicity. If you look at the formula here, you have your d prime here and your gamma prime. So I did the computation here for the d prime and the gamma prime, actually. I just omitted the d prime and gamma prime. You can have here a prime, you know, here primes, and propagate the primes through. Doesn't change the relationship that the h of d times sine gamma is gamma divided by sine gamma square, and so on. It's very technical. I agree, and I never did this before in this lecture. But Andreas was thinking that this is important, so we added this to the original plan of the lecture. So I did it once. I do not do it for flat detectors because then it's even getting more weird. For the curve detector here, it's rather okay. You can do that. You see here the cosine weighting. That means what is the shape of the cosine function? It's going like this. Yeah. So here is p half. And that means here is 1. And the farther you are away, the larger the angle gets, the smaller the weight will be. And that helps us also, you know, if the angle widens up, the measurements that are far away get a lower weight. That's the cosine weighting. Then you have here your measurement, and here you have your convolution kernel that is written above, and that's a modified angle-dependent Ram filter. Yeah, gamma-dependent Ram filter. That's it. Okay. So if you want to implement filtered back projection using fan beam geometry, you can use this wonderful formula, and you end up with a very similar algorithm: signal, pre-weighted signal, convolved with a high-pass filter that is a little bit differently to the one we knew from the parallel setup, and then you can do the filtered back projection. Okay. And I can tell you, if you have a system that is, let's say, close to 20 years old with a flat panel detector, that time we didn't understand the reconstruction formulas that deeply as we understand it today. So there were a few approximations that are not very close to the formulas we have here on the blackboard. So if you want to see things, you can also allow for a few mistakes. So if you avoid cosine weighting, you still get images that look very nice, yeah, even if the function that you reconstructed is not as correct as you expected it. But for diagnostic purposes, at this time it was okay. Good. Any questions? Do you find this exciting, Tobias?
Interesting to apply this. But I have a question.
You have a question?
I couldn't follow over there. So we replace omega by omega times p times sinus gamma, and then where does the p-factor come from?
Well, if I multiply now omega with this factor, I fall back to the old omega. If I multiply this with this factor, I fall back to the original omega. And the same here, I have to multiply here the omega with the prefactor, and if I multiply this here over the integrals, then it disappears. So we have to have the square here. Good. So for me, the important message is, you also end up with a filtered back projection algorithm for fan beam geometry. It's a little bit different. You have to do a cosine weighting of the measurements and a different convolution kernel. But the overall reconstruction method from a certain point of distance, 10,000 feet height, is the same. Yeah, and that's nice. And from a computer science point of view, it's also nice because the cosine weighting of the input signal can be done before you feed in this into the reconstruction machine. And the reconstruction machine has as a parameter also the convolution kernel. So you can use the hardware accelerated reconstruction machine to do the reconstruction also for the fan beam reconstruction. Or in other words, if you work collaborate with an electrical engineer who implemented an FPGA version of a reconstruction machine that does the job pretty fast, you can use his module by just preparing the data that you feed into the reconstruction machine. You don't have to re-implement things. And that's also something that engineers always have to keep in mind. If you improve your system and you have hardware accelerators and certain software packages that are already tested and approved according to the law for medical products and things like that, try to reuse it as much as possible. That's a design request, yeah? Because otherwise you have to do all the testing and all the administrative quality stuff again and again and again, and that's a pain. Yeah? The worst thing you can do is do all the quality stuff. I'm sure I already told you, but it's a nice story. I once did with a colleague a code review in industry. And a code review means you take 4 eyes and you review the code. And it's so boring. And do you know how you feel if you look at a code of somebody else?
Yes.
It's horrible, right?
Yes.
It's horrible. And so he had to look at my code, and I had to look at his code. And he was not familiar with templates, and he was making fun of me because I have code segments in the header files. So we had a very nice afternoon together. It was horrible. And at some point, we agreed that we have joint coffee, we have fun, and what he wrote is fine, and what I wrote is fine without looking into it into detail. So, and then we were discussing the point, look, I mean, if I cannot understand your code, and you cannot understand my code, do you think the quality guys who are going to control things will notice whether we did a proper cross-check? And then we came up with the idea, why don't we write the date in Roman numbers? Because you have to sign and say, okay, it's December 8, 2014, and we wrote the date in Roman numbers just to check what's going to happen. And guess what? We gave a staple of documents, paper, we gave to the quality office, and on a single paper out of, let's say, 1,000 papers had the Roman date. And guess what happened? It came back. They noticed it, but they didn't notice that in my code there was an engineering constant like set D to 0.7, and then there was a comment, this is just by experiments approved or something like that. I mean, that's the weird thing in the code, but that's what nobody checked. So what is the conclusion out of that?
Have you made fun of the quality?
Yes. And it also means that you are basically in charge of your own code. Yeah, I mean, all these quality things that don't make your code that much better. And if the quality guys are watching this video, they will, of course, contradict. But you can do a little test. I mean, if your quality guy is complaining about something, ask him to write 3 lines of code for Hello World or something like that. He will fail for sure. It's also if somebody applies for a PhD position in my lab out of the blue. Quite often I start the interview with which question? What question do I ask first? What do you think? Huh? That's right. I ask, can you write the Fourier transform? And I say, I know it's trivial, but please write it down. I don't care about constants and things like that. Can you write down the Fourier transform? And guess if somebody applies out of the blue, more than 50% cannot write the Fourier transform. And guess what happens with the interview if you cannot write it down? It's finished, yeah. I save my time and the guy saves his time. Pardon? How do you enjoy life and what's fun for you? And then it's more the superficial blah blah. Yeah.
Isn't there the board to look things up? So if I know there's a Fourier transform, so
Yeah, I mean that's the point with prior knowledge and pattern recognition, yeah. I really want to make sure that people know it or they just can write a little program that plot some dots, 15 dots on the screen or something like that, just to make sure that they can deal with it, you know? But I don't ask these questions to students that I monitored for 2 or more semesters in an arena like this. Usually I pick out the right ones and ask you. And I don't care about grades, actually. If I have the feeling you are good, then usually you can make it to the lab. Good. Okay. Oh, jetzt habe ich hier 2 HDMI-Kabel. Mhm. Okay. Ah, wonderful. It's coming. Here, for instance, where is my pointer? No pointer. Here is my pointer. Here you find also the derivation in Zeng's book. Yeah, I mean, if you have Zeng's book, you can see all the derivations. And it's very easy to read. It's written in an American style, so it's just reading and oops, you see it. Good. Sorry. So. What? Got funny emails? That is the formula that you should be able to write by heart. Yeah? Convolution and back projection. Convolution, back projection, parallel projection model. Here the straight line equation, and that's the kernel. That's the RAM filter. And then we did all the massaging of the formulas on the blackboard. And that's the algorithm we end up with. So what we do is a cosine weighting. That means we multiply for a given beta, yeah? For a given rotation angle, we take all the gammas, and we have the measurements G gamma beta. And we weight each and single measurement with a cosine gamma. Yeah, that means the farther the measurement deviates from the central projection rate, the lower the weight is. That's the cosine weighting. Then we apply the fan beam filter. That's the definition I did on the blackboard before. And we convolve the cosine weighted measurement with a fan beam, with the fan beam filter. We convolve it. Convolution is supported by tons of hardware that is available nowadays. If you want to convolve it in frequency domain, what do you have to do? You compute the Fourier transform of the measurement, you compute the Fourier transform of the filter kernel, and you multiply the Fourier transforms. And then you back project, but here you have to do a distance weighting. That's 1 over d prime square. And 1 over d prime square, d prime was the distance of the current point that we are reconstructing, the distance to the focal point of our X-ray tube. And that's the reconstruction algorithm. So we have two weighting schemes, one for the measurement and one at the end for the back projection. It's distance dependent. So the larger the distance is, the smaller the weight will be. Okay? So we can look at different back projections. For instance, that's the slice we want to reconstruct. That is one projection that we get by using a fan beam. That is the filtered projection, and then we smear it back, and the smearing back is no longer with parallel streaks because we have this fan beam angle stuff. So you have this diverging lines, non-parallel lines, and then you can compute, for instance, the inverse Fourier transform of the back smearing here. And this is the reconstruction result you get from fan beam data. Here you see it's not so homogeneous in the middle. That is due to the limited number of projections that we use for reconstruction. But you can reconstruct. Yeah? You can reconstruct. How would you calibrate your system? I mean, we have seen you have to do the d gamma prime representation. So that means you need to know where your focal point is in space. And that has to be computed. I mean, if you set up an X-ray system, you have to compute the focal point in space. How do you compute that? We had one chapter on calibration, where you put a calibration pattern into your X-ray system in between the X-ray tube and the detector. You know the coordinates of the bullets that are in the calibration pattern, yes?
Can I take symmetrical 3D object. First, this was a 2D with dots. Now I take 3D.
Yeah.
With,
yeah. I mean, cubes. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you are a late student in this lecture. So we have seen the calibration pattern with the helix structure, with the bullets on the helix, with the encoding of the position that we are considering in the projection using the diameter of the bullets, yeah? And yeah, so we have a binary encoding. And using these points, you can compute the extrinsic and intrinsic parameters of your X-ray system. What are extrinsic, intrinsic parameters, the extrinsic ones?
Where the setup is, and the intrinsic should be the focal length in such space.
Yeah, how many extrinsic parameters do we have? Extrinsic?
Six.
Six, rotation, three angles, translation, three components. And intrinsics? How many?
Five.
How did you know that? Good. Why not six? I can tell you six. That's the point of the origin, two coordinates. That's the angle between the coordinate axes, one. Then we have the focal distance, and then we have the scaling in x and y direction. Why only five? I told you six already.
Scaling
that may.
And the focal length, they're intertwined.
They are in a product, and we cannot split it up, right? Very good. 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 And then in the following, we have to look at the final algorithm first. So we have here the conversion. We have here the transformation, the Jacobian. We do the back projection, and we end up with the overall algorithm. That's something we understood so far. And now we look into the following situation. So we have the problem of redundancy. Yes.
It's a very technical question, but in practice, so we have to do discrete values for the convolution, because we have to do a discrete convolution. How big should our kernel be? So how big should we make it?
What does the theory tell us? Infinity, right? What does practice tell us? What we use is usually a power of two. So we take a kernel size of 1024 or 1048 or something like that. If your detector is 512 or 1024, we take this type of kernel. Why do we take a power of two? What do you think? Yeah, if you use the Fourier transform, you have way more efficient algorithms if your kernel length is a power of two. Yeah? If you don't have a power of two, you can do zero padding. That's something you should have seen in the exercises. Redundancy. So if I have here my X-ray tube, and if I look at my measurement here, and here I have my object, it doesn't matter whether I send the X-ray particles from this side to this side or from this side to this side. Doesn't matter, right? Does it matter? No, it does not matter. I get. Yeah, you are so practical. We don't think about scattering. Yeah, it's the ideal situation. Okay, no scattering, no nothing. So it makes no difference. And here you also have, if you have for instance fan beam, you also have here a projection ray that goes from here to here. But we can also think of a situation that we have projection like this. So we have also here some rays that are measured twice and some rays that are measured just once. And what the reconstruction guys did, they looked at the whole setup, which rays are considered twice or measured twice, and which rays are measured just once if I rotate by 180 degrees around the patient. And then you have to do a proper weighting of these data, because some data are generated twice and some data are generated just once. And the weighting scheme is also some kind of art. And there is one standard weighting scheme that is called Parker weighting, where you have to choose proper weights for your beams to make sure that all the measurements have the same contribution, or all the line integrals that you need for reconstruction have the same contribution, and you don't have an overweight of certain projection lines. And here again, we have the situation that I'm more than happy with having the idea in mind. There are rays that are measured twice or even more often, and then you can look up the weighting scheme, or you can sit down and think about the weighting scheme here in the lecture to derive the weighting scheme and which angles are considered twice and blah, blah, blah. For me, it's very technical, and I don't think that you get so much benefit out of that. That's why I skipped this chapter or section in the previous years, but then Andreas Meyer was giving the lecture and he was thinking that's very important. So if you have the oral exam with Andreas Meyer, you have to learn all the formulas. If you are with me, it's sufficient to give me a scenario like this without the super duper intelligent comment that it makes a difference due to scattering. Yeah. Okay. So here is the scenario again. Andreas was looking at the situation, when do you have identical rays and blah, blah, blah. I don't go through it. And you get here a proper weighting. It's a Parker weighting scheme where you get some sine cosine weights for certain angles. For me, it's totally fine if you tell me that you have certain areas. Usually the weights look like this. If you are at the borderline, if you have a 180 degree rotation, it's clear if you look from both sides with a 180 degree offset, your overlap will be higher than in the range where you just have one view. Yeah? If you rotate for 180 degrees around the patient, the overlap here with here will be large, and here there will be close to no overlap. And that means that the rays at the beginning and at the end will have a lower weight. And this is expressed here by the gray level encoded weights for the beams for different gamma and beta values. Yeah? So these are the Parker weights. And here you can incorporate the Parker weights, and the only thing that changes in addition to the cosine weighting, you have before the Parker weighting telling us which beams are measured twice and which not. You have here different weightings, then you have the cosine weighting, you have your fan beam, and then your back projection distance weighted. That's the full-blown version for reconstruction. Yeah? Parker weighting is required to have a proper weighting for redundantly measured signals. Yeah, and here's an example. If you have no redundancy weighting, then you get these artifacts in there. If you don't have redundancy weighting and reconstruction, you get here some artifacts. So it happens that the reconstruction result is not that properly done. Good. So, further readings. Is the book already available now for you? Is there anybody who has not the book of Larry? You all have the book, the PDF? You didn't look for it? Okay, you are relaxed. You say, if Hornegger is not explaining it, it's not important. Okay, it's fine with me as well. The Parker weighting, you can read in a very old paper, 1982. And Parker is a professor in the same lab like Larry Tseng. And I once visited them there, and then I met him, and it's interesting to meet these famous people. Yeah, he's no longer in CT reconstruction. He's now totally focusing on MR. So that was one research he did in his early days, and he moved on. And he's still very happy that this is still the standard of dealing with redundancy. Good. So I think we should quit here and not start a new chapter. What we will start do next time is we will look at the problem of truncation. You know what truncation is? Truncation means that you cannot see the complete object on the detector. So you miss parts. For instance, you miss an arm or part of the belly because the detector is too small. And the question is, how can you correct for the missing data? And we all know how to correct for missing data. For instance, interpolation, extrapolation is something. But there are also several other ideas that are implemented in CT scanners, and we will look into these on Thursday. Thank you very much, and have a nice week.